This is Weathering Change, the podcast that takes questions from climate adaptation professionals and gets answers from experts. It's a complicated field, and we're learning together. I'm Ned Gardner, recording this on August 30th, 2019. Today, we'll be addressing climate science questions from Olaf Hansen, Lindsay Webb, Leslie Curian, John Callahan, Jane Hines, Aaron Copeland, Colleen Sanders, and Arjita Rai. Thanks for your questions. These are based on a webinar that we recorded yesterday, August 29th, and there's a link to that on the website with this recording. We're going to get to their questions shortly, but I'll get things started with today's guest, Eric Osterberg. Eric is an associate professor of earth sciences at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. When we scheduled this, I took a look at your website, and two things struck me. First, the grandiosity of the mountain landscape in the background with your main picture. I think it was from Alaska, from one of your field seasons. And the second thing that I really caught my eye was how much you value undergraduate education. So I have a two-part question for you to get things started. As an earth scientist, how does the story of earth shape your worldview? Which may sound redundant, but by that I mean how you interact with people, how you do your work. And as a mirror to that question, what is it like to see a young person to start to get it, meaning for them to relate to the vastness of time and Earth's history and incredible processes that make this planet habitable?
Wow, that's a great question, Ned. And thanks again for having me on for this webcast. So, you know, as an earth scientist, the sort of long history of geological time, the 4.5 billion years of this planet's history, is something that's just always with me. Just even just walking around campus here, or when I'm driving down the road and looking at the landscape around me, or especially when I'm in an airplane and looking down out of the window onto the landscape below, what I see in my mind is just this amazing planet, and I can see it kind of evolving to the point that we are today in my mind's eye, and imagining, you know, what it looked like just even a few hundred years ago after 4 billion years of evolution of the rocks and of life on this planet, and then how much it's changed just so incredibly dramatically just over the past couple hundred years, really, at least here in North America, right? A little longer in other places, but just in the last this whisker of time that humans have really been transforming this planet, and we've done a remarkable job of it, for better and for worse. That's what I see every time I look at the landscape, and it's something that I try to convey to my students. I think it's hard when you have, say, an hour, you know, three times a week in a class setting to try and get that across. But I make a point of talking to the students about that, of saying, you know, when you're walking to class, you know, it's just for that 10 minutes. Please, like, put your phone back in your pocket and take out your earbuds and look around. Like, notice the weather. Notice the landscape. Notice the trees. Notice the way that you're interacting with it. Notice how it's changing. And I hope that at least some of them do that. And I think some of them do sort of take up that challenge and try and see the world through the lens of an earth scientist for a little while. And one of the things I try and do in my undergraduate classes is to use this amazing geological history of the Earth, the story of how our planet came to look like it does today, to use that story as a context for understanding what we are now doing to the planet today and just how unusual and how damaging it is, right? And it takes on another level of seriousness and concern for me when I think of it that way, right? We're not just sort of, you know, hurting ourselves. Like, when we think about climate change impacts, we're usually talking about impacts on humans. But I think about it also just in terms of our impact on every living thing on this planet and everything that's lived before us that helped make the planet look like it does today. Like, you know, we're the first sentient being on this planet. We're the first life form on this planet that has the capability of understanding what we're doing and actually changing its actions. And it sort of weighs on me that so far, at least, we've been really slow to take that seriously, take our stewardship of this planet seriously. On the other hand, you know, as an earth scientist, I also know that the planet's been through crazy times in the past, right? Meteorite impacts that wiped out life almost so many times. We've had sort of extinction-level events that have almost taken out life on this planet, and every time life has bounced back. So when I think about it as a geologist, I also know that, you know, no matter what we do to this planet, eventually it's going to bounce back. We're going to be gone, and a lot of the other life forms today will be gone, and this planet will carry on. Life will carry on, and that actually helps to give me quite a bit of sort of geological hope, right? That no matter, we can do our worst, but the planet will go on and life will go on. So it's an interesting sort of additional weight that I carry with that, the sort of responsibility we have to be a good steward, but then also that knowledge that, well, you know, even if this goes horribly wrong, life will go on.
It's such a long history. It's very hard for humans to comprehend time on the scales that form mountains and erode them away form glaciers. But your work literally gets to the heart of understanding massive shifts in Earth's climate. Since the group I work with builds the climate.gov website and the toolkit, the U.S. Climate Resilience Toolkit website, data and reports and assessments of the climate are really at the heart of what NOAA can contribute to a conversation around climate change and adaptation. But I always am reminded when I talk to a field scientist that there are people fortunate enough to get to go to these incredible places and touch the climate record with their hands. And I think it's an important reminder, because when climate comes up in conversation in our society in general, people focus on decisions we're making and policy and humans, but there's this incredible other story about our planet. So let's get to some questions that we have from our audience. Arjita Rai asks, wants to know more about the dynamics of the 2019 ice sheet loss, presumably in Greenland, and wants to know whether that's going to affect ocean temperature, which therefore might impact weather in New England.
First, we'll just tackle what's happening in Greenland just this summer, just in the past few weeks, when it's been in the headlines, not just because our president is interested in buying it, but because it went through a pretty big heat wave in the early part of August, and that followed another heat wave back in July, when we know that there was quite a bit of melting going on in Greenland. And, you know, for us as climatologists, 2012 really sticks out in our mind for Greenland. That was the hottest summer that we have on record recently, that we had a big melt event. And that was really encapsulated by melting at the very summit of the ice sheet at a camp that we call appropriately Summit Greenland. And, you know, the last time that temperatures were above freezing at Summit was in the 1880s. And so we went through the entire 1900s, the whole 20th century, without a single minute or hour that was above freezing up at Summit. And then in 2012, we had a melt event that there were several hours, I think over at least two different days. And that was a remarkable event. And then this summer happened. And my lab manager, Dave Ferris, he keeps very close track of these things, and he has lots of friends who are stationed up at Summit, and he was sending me frantic emails saying, Have you seen? Like, Summit's back above freezing again, I think. But what's crazy is, Ned, the thermometer sensors that you can look at online, they don't even go above freezing. So the way that we can tell that it's above freezing at Summit is that you can see the temperature going up and up and up and up, and then it just stops, because it doesn't go above freezing. So it was remarkable. We were emailing our colleagues at Summit saying, is it true? Like, is it above freezing again? And they were saying, yes, looks like we got above freezing for at least a few hours. So this summer, the jury's out. I have on my list of one of my colleagues, Zoe Corville, who works up the road at the Cold Regions Research Lab. It's a military lab who does glacier research. She just came back from Summit. And I asked her to dig a snow pit to see if she could see one of these refrozen melt layers, a layer that forms when you get the surface melt and then it refreezes just a little below the surface. And so I haven't had a chance to ask her yet if she could find one and if it was bigger than 2012, but I have a feeling that this summer is going to beat out 2012. And that's part of, you know, that's a part of the pattern that I showed in the talk, which is that these summers are happening more and more. We're just getting more and more melt. Melt at summit was basically unheard of until very recently, and now we're getting every few years, and, you know, another decade or two in the future, it'll perhaps be every year. So in terms of changing the ocean temperatures, you know, the way that it potentially could affect ocean temperatures is probably by affecting the ocean currents. You know, I mentioned the Gulf Stream the other day, and it turns out that the Gulf Stream is actually driven in part by density differences between the water in the northern part of the Atlantic Ocean and the water down, say, in the Gulf of Mexico. And so when you add that meltwater to the ocean from the glacier, of course, that's fresh water, right? And so you're adding fresh water to the ocean, and so that makes the ocean less salty. And so that can affect the density differences between the northern Atlantic and the tropics, and that can affect the Gulf Stream. And the Gulf Stream has a big impact on ocean temperatures, at least nearby to our east coast here. So it's possible, but I think the bigger concern would be, you know, this meltwater adding to the ocean and then therefore raising sea level, right? That's the story that we're much more concerned about now rather than the ocean temperatures. It's what is the level of the ocean and how fast is that rising? And Greenland is a big part of that story, as I showed in the webinar.
Well, and Arjita also was asking about hurricanes. So if there's sea level rise, any hurricane would have a greater impact due to storm surge on a higher ocean level.
So exactly. Yeah. So these, you know, even if you imagine that the hurricanes aren't being affected by global warming at all, and that's as I showed in the talk, that's not true. But let's just pretend that that's true, that the hurricanes are not changing. The only thing that's changing is that sea level is going up. So if you have the same hurricane hit in 1950 when sea level was lower, it's going to cause, you know, a certain amount of flooding. And if that same exact hurricane hits today when sea level's, another foot higher, the damage is going to not just be sort of a linear increase, but it's actually an exponential increase in damage because, you know, our coastlines generally have very low slopes on the East Coast. So they're very flat coastlines. So even a small increase in sea level means that that storm surge, that flooding that comes in with the storm can reach much further inland. Right? It's not like it goes up a foot and so it can only reach a foot further inland. You go up a foot in sea level and maybe now you can go another 500 meters inland. So it's a nonlinear relationship there between sea level rise and the damage you get from these storms. And, you know, this is hitting home right now. Like literally 10 minutes ago, just before we started this, I was getting emails from my parents. Folks may know that Hurricane Dorian is bearing down on Florida for the weekend. It looks like it's going to hit somewhere around the middle of the east coast of Florida, just north of Fort Lauderdale. But it looks like it's going to go right over the Abaco Islands of the Bahamas, and that's a place that my parents and I have actually spent some time on vacations. And those Bahamian Islands, those are very low. These are basically, you know, sandbars. And right now, the hurricane's supposed to go right over the Abaco Islands, right over Great Guyana Island. And, you know, this is potentially devastating for them, and then it's going to continue on to Florida. And, you know, the difference between an extra foot of sea level rise could be the difference between these islands being completely wiped out and these islands being able to weather this storm. So we're cautiously holding our breath, hoping the storm veers off to the north or south and misses the Abacos and misses everywhere else. But it's looking like it's right in the crosshairs right now.
Well, that brings up a question from John Callahan, who was also interested in models suggest that while hurricane numbers overall may not increase in a warmer world, the intensity of storms it's likely to be greater, of hurricanes, I should say, tropical right. cyclones and hurricanes. And so he wanted to know, is there likely to be an impact on storm paths? Are they going to be making more landfalls or going out to the North Atlantic more? So he wants to know, should we focus on strength of storms or where they happen?
He's exactly right that our latest research does suggest that the total number of hurricanes may not change. And in fact, it could even go down a little bit. But that with the warmer sea surface temperatures, warmer ocean water is gasoline. It's gasoline for hurricanes. And you get warmer water and it just supercharges these things. And so if the atmospheric conditions are conducive to a hurricane forming, then those really warm ocean waters make it really big. So we may even get fewer hurricanes in the future, but the ones that do form are more likely to be major hurricanes, category 3, 4, and 5. And those are the ones, anyone who follows hurricanes, those are the ones you worry about for impacts on people, on infrastructure, on cities. Dorian looks to be a category 3 or 4. And even the hurricanes that affect us here in the Northeast, oftentimes by the time they get here, they're a category 1 or maybe even a tropical storm or maybe even just a tropical depression. But those storms, if they make it up to the Northeast as a category 1, that means they were probably a category 3, 4, or 5 down near Florida and in the Caribbean. Now, the question about their storm path is a fascinating question. And so the storm paths are generally sort of set by the large patterns of high and low pressure in the atmosphere. And so, for example, in the summertime, there's a big high pressure center that sits right over Bermuda, and that helps to steer storms that form sort of the left of Bermuda because the high has a clockwise rotation. Now, that high starts to break down a little bit as you go into the fall when hurricane season continues to ramp up. So it is really hard for us to predict how hurricane paths will change. And, the question is really astute because if we have really big, powerful hurricanes and they all head out to sea, well, then who cares, right? That's actually good news for us if the paths would change and take them all out to sea. There's no reason to think that that will happen. There's reason to suspect that we would continue to see the sort of diversity of paths where, depending on the conditions that particular day and that particular week that the hurricane is coming through the Caribbean and up the coast, that we would tend to get some that go out to sea and some that head straight for land. Now, there is some really interesting research about the jet stream, and that's research that a lot of people have been doing, and my group has as well, so I'm really up to date on this stuff with the jet stream. And what we found is that the jet stream tends to slow down and tends to get wavier during warmer conditions in the Arctic, and which is what we expect with climate change, and it's what we've seen. And so I talked about that in the webinar, that we've seen the jet stream get wavier. Now, what can happen with that is that you start getting really interesting storm paths that we haven't seen before. And the classic example of this is Hurricane Sandy. Now, the week before Sandy hit New Jersey with devastating effect, I was actually giving a seminar at our local science museum here to a bunch of high school teachers. And at that time, there was one model that suggested that the hurricane was going to track up the East Coast and then take a left turn and go straight into New Jersey. And the teachers asked me, what do you think? Do you think it could hit New Jersey? And I said, absolutely not. There's no way this storm is going to make a left-hand turn as far north as New Jersey because the winds go from west to east up there. It just doesn't happen. We've never seen a storm do that before. And sure enough, the model was right, and I was dead wrong. And again, with devastating impact, it came up to New Jersey and then took a hard left turn. And the reason it did that is because there was this really big wave in the jet stream that caused a really big high pressure center over Greenland, and it kicked the storm to the west. Like I said, we'd never seen that before. And so one of the things I've been researching in Greenland is that we do see more of these big high pressure centers over Greenland, which is caused by the wavy jet stream. And if that is, in fact, something that persists into the future, we might actually get more hurricanes instead of heading out to sea, doing what Sandy did and getting kicked back into the U.S. East Coast. But the jury is very much out on that. It's an awesome question. It's an area of research, but we don't have a good answer right now for exactly what will happen. But these are the things that we're thinking about.
Yeah, it's definitely an area of very active research at NOAA, the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab at Princeton, which is a NOAA lab that produces a climate model, is one of the groups that's very active in producing the hurricane, producing a physics-based hurricane model that's taken from the climate research community and being used in the weather operational prediction of hurricanes. So this is an area that's obviously very much at the core of NOAA's mission is understanding the behavior of hurricanes, both in a weather context and climate. So definitely, I would recommend people look into some of that research if they're interested in the subject. There were a lot of people interested in hurricanes on the webinar, so you definitely captured a lot of interest. One person was asking about you showed a pie graph of the types of extreme precipitation events that have struck New England in recent decades, and one type that brought a lot of rainfall was hurricanes. Another type was frontal systems. And then you had another wedge, which was about 12% of the rainfall, I suppose, from the weather stations coming from other storms. So Lindsay Webb is wondering, what is this other category? And what would be included in that category?
The way that we did this analysis was, rather than categorize every single extreme storm that hit the Northeast over the past several decades, that would have been, it turned out, somewhere around 3,000 extreme storms. And that would have just been an unreasonable amount of work, even for my PhD student, which, you know, they're used to unreasonable amounts of work. So what we found out, actually what he found out, Wan Ping, our grad student on this project, what he found out is that, yes, we had 3,000 of these extreme storms, but that 90% of that change, that jump that we saw in 1996, 90% of that jump could be explained by only 273 storms. Okay, so we didn't have to worry about these other thousands of storms because they only contributed a tiny little bit to that jump. And then that made the problem of categorizing them way more manageable. And so he also found out that those 273 storms only happened in 6 out of the 12 months. Okay, so we didn't even have to look at the whole year. We just had to look at February and March, June and July, and September and October. If we just looked at those 6 months, we could explain 90% of this jump.
We should probably recap also that when you said a jump in 1996, there was essentially no trend in extreme precipitation events in New England prior to 1996, going back when, to 1895 or 1900?
Yeah, 1901, I think.
1901. And then there's a whole new regime that began in 1996 up to the present.
Yeah.
Where you're seeing.
And that's the way to think about it. It's a new regime. We're in a new normal now. And it wasn't a slow change over a couple years or decades. It was literally a step change to a new regime that had 50% more extreme rainfall since 1996. And so that other category that's in that pie chart is basically storms that occurred in the other 6 months that we didn't categorize, and so we didn't get into those details. But again, we thought we were doing pretty well with capturing, I think, 89% of that jump without having to spend years and years and years trying to categorize these 3,000 storms.
That seems fair to me. And yes, I mean, the whole idea of looking at extreme events, that's something that's documented in the National Climate Assessment, too, is that more and more of the rainfall, especially in New England, is coming from extreme events, which are themselves the more rare but high-impact storms. So it's definitely an area that's getting a lot of attention. We've got a few questions that get to the core of your research. Sorry for the pun. You study ice cores and snow accumulation, and you described a technique for looking at the annual accumulation of snow and being able to see the melt layer and its freezing and therefore being able to date cores. But Jane Hines was curious, how do you age bands that go back 125,000 years?
We can count the annual layers back anywhere from depends on the site, right? It depends on how much snow falls at each site. So if enough snow falls, then we can go back, say, 10,000 years of this counting. And then eventually the layers just get so thin because they're squished under so much ice that we just can't actually see them. So the longest that I know somebody has counted annual layers back was around 40 or 45,000 years. And you can imagine somebody actually sitting down and doing that over a series of – I think it took them years. So how do we go back further than that, right? I showed a plot that goes back 800,000 years. And so to do that, you start to have to use various techniques and the uncertainties start to go up. So one way that we can do it is just by modeling the depth age curve of the glacier, modeling how deep a certain age of ice should be in the glacier if we know the temperature and if we know how much snow falls there. And it turns out that those models work really well, assuming that you know those things. And of course we do, because we're researching the climate there. And especially if you can constrain the model with these annual layer counts at the top and make sure that your model is doing a good job when you actually can count these layers, then you can have much more confidence further down deep. So that's the first thing that we'll do is we'll just do a – and it's actually a relatively simple equation. So we'll just do one of these call them glacier flow models to figure out how deep the ice should be down there. And then we can check it against other records that have better age control, right? So we can look for big volcanic eruptions. Like there's the big Toba volcanic eruption. I think that's the largest one of the last 100,000 or years or so that happened about 80,000 years ago. So we know when that eruption happened because other scientists have gone and actually used radiometric dating techniques to date the ash from that volcano. And so when we see that in the ice core, again, we can check our time scale, make sure our model is doing a good job of telling us what the estimated age is. And then another way that people do it, you know, I talked about the orbital pacing of the ice ages, right? The fact that tiny changes in Earth's orbit around the sun is what paces when we have the ice ages and when we come out of them into a warm period. And so there's so many, there are literally hundreds of records from the ocean that prove that that's right. And so we can then tie our ice core records to some of these other records that have been dated based on that pacing of the ice ages. So there's a whole series of different ways we do it. Annual layer counting is the best way to do it. It has the lowest uncertainties. And again, these other methods will have slightly higher uncertainties. But in general, ice cores are one of, if not the best dated paleoclimate techniques that we have.
I would note that even when people are counting rings on trees, uncertainties come in, and it's really the correlation of multiple lines of evidence that helps calibrate even a dendrochronology or a tree core record. So that's really interesting to hear about all those different techniques.
Yeah. And, you know, the scientific method is such that we're constantly improving it. So it's not like these timescales are fixed forever. So what usually happens is that we put out several versions of a timescale for an ice core, and the timescales will keep getting better and better and better as we build up additional confirmatory information about, say, specific events. So, for example, some of these volcanic eruptions I talk about, you know, a lot of them we know exactly when they were, but some of them we know maybe within an uncertainty of 10 or 20 years, if it's, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. And then maybe somebody else comes along and uses a better technique, and now they've got that uncertainty down to plus or minus 2 years. Well, then that means that our timescale can now be shifted a little bit, and that's another iteration of the timescale. And so what you'll see in the literature is that people are constantly improving these timescales as we get more information.
That reminds me, we spoke offline about the sharing of information. It's a fairly small community, a few hundred people around the world who are in your area of research and glaciology very broadly, and that you have ice cores that you've collected from around the world. Could you maybe share a story of how important that is to share the data, but even the physical evidence itself, and how that leads to more and more discovery?
One of the key aspects of sort of robust and productive science is not just sharing your methods, sharing your raw data, making everything as transparent as it can be. And I think the ice core community, because we're relatively small, has done this very well. So I think I shared with you that, you know, we've developed this ice core melt analysis system, this way that we actually melt the ice core so that we can chemically analyze it. And that took, you know, years and years and years of engineering and trial and error, trying to get everything right, trying to make sure our samples are clean, trying to get our sample size to be as small as possible. And what we do is we share that openly with the entire international community. We've actually made some of these melter parts ourselves and then just shipped them off to our colleagues in other countries at cost. We're not asking even for money back on it except to cover our costs. In fact, my lab manager was just up in Canada just 2 weeks ago. There's a colleague of ours who's just starting up the Canadian National Ice Core Lab, and she's building an ice melter system. And she knows that me and my lab manager are sort of at the forefront of building this technology. And so he just went up there and spent a week with her talking about it, sharing it. He actually brought some of the pieces with him so that he could install it for her and help make sure that their lab was going to get up and running and be successful. And so that's, you know, on the method side. And then the data side, of course, we have to it's now NSF requirements, and it's a fantastic requirement. They're now actually enforcing this, that we have to share all of our data publicly. I mean, this is the taxpayers. This is the U.S. taxpayers who are funding this research. It belongs to everybody.
And that's a change that's happened really in our lifetime. I mean, that policy has really shifted, and I think it's because of more and more recognition of how important it is that we understand the Earth system.
Absolutely. And understand, you know, it's a lot of money to go off and do these things. And, you know, it's not my data. This is the taxpayers' data. This is the world's data, really. And anyone who wants to use it and can analyze it and benefit from it, learn something new from it, go for it. I mean, we don't have the time to look at every possible aspect of the data that we can. So hopefully other people are getting their brains on it too and making contributions. You know, of course, it's a little intimidating sometimes to put that data out there because you don't know what people are going to do with it and you want to make sure you get credit for it. But in general, the ice core community is, I think, really good about making sure their data is out there so that everybody can access it.
Well, a couple of people were interested in your research community's ability to continue collecting data with so much ice melting. Leslie Kurian was asking, with ice melt occurring at an increasing rate, say on Greenland, are you losing access to important areas for collecting ice cores?
Yeah, we absolutely are. And it hasn't really impacted us in Greenland or Antarctica yet. The place that we see it the most is in the mountain glaciers. So, for example, you can go to glaciers in the Himalayas where some of our colleagues, a famous ice core scientist, Lonnie Thompson, who works out of Ohio State, he was collecting ice cores in the Himalayas back in the 80s. And he was getting, you know, there was still snow up there that was deposited the year before. You can now go to those glaciers today, the same place that he collected those ice cores. And the ice that's on the surface now is from, say, the 1940s or the 1950s, meaning that you're not preserving any of the new snow, and the glacier is actually melting down into those older years that already accumulated there. And so we are literally losing these archives. And so it hasn't really been framed in that way in the United States ice core community, but I know that there's a group of European ice core researchers who are actually targeting these glaciers where the melt is such that we are at risk of permanently losing some of these records and trying to go and collect them. Even if they can't analyze it right now, just go collect it before it's gone. And so, for example, Kilimanjaro, right? The glacier in Kilimanjaro is – the top of Kilimanjaro is not going to be there for much longer. I've got a colleague who works in the Rwenzori Mountains in Uganda, and those glaciers are almost gone. Right. And then once they're gone, you can never get that ice core record back. So, yes, it's a real issue in the mountain glaciers. And there are people who are actively going around just trying to preserve them by collecting the ice now while we can.
The group I used to work with at the American Museum of Natural History documented a story about Lonnie Thompson collecting data in the Andes from Calcaya Glacier. So I'll post that along with this. We'll put a video up. People can see little bit about what field work looks like too. So someone else was asking about your research and wanted to know, well, you addressed the question yesterday from Olaf Hansen about the effect of melting permafrost on the release of methane. Did you want to add anything to that? I noticed that in my notes here.
You know, so as we talked about yesterday, I think the methane is a critical problem that we need to really wrap our hands around, because it does have the potential, just because there's so much methane locked in the permafrost, that again, like if everything goes wrong, that has the potential to be a major problem to accelerate the warming. But I think the jury is still very much out on exactly what that impact will be.
Here's a question going back to the ocean. And Colleen Sanders was curious whether the release of carbon dioxide from the ocean, along with a warming ocean, you talked about the stoichiometry, the chemistry of a warmer ocean holding less carbon dioxide.
Right.
Will that also affect ocean acidification, maybe in a positive way? Will ocean acidification improve with less carbon dioxide in the water if the water is warmer?
Yeah, that's an interesting question that I hadn't actually considered. I think that one of the things that we'd have to consider, you know, when we think about ocean acidification, what troubles me the most about it is thinking about its effects on organisms that make their shells, their hard parts, out of basically chalk, right? Calcium carbonate. And because that calcium carbonate is so easy to dissolve once the water becomes a little acidic. And so you can imagine that if you're a little critter and you make your shell or your exoskeleton or what have you out of calcium carbonate, and it starts dissolving away, that's obviously not good for your livelihood. So, you know, we think about it for those organisms. We think about it for things like coral reefs. And when we think about CO2 being outgassed or being absorbed by the ocean, that is generally happening in sort of particular places, right? And particularly in the Southern Ocean, is the ocean that's around Antarctica. That's the area where there's the most exchange of CO2 in and out of the oceans. And I mentioned the temperature effect yesterday because that's a particularly intuitive way to talk about it. But it turns out that's only part of why we see these natural changes in CO2. So the other things that are happening is that actually changes in where the ocean water is rising and sinking. Meaning you've got deep ocean water coming up to the surface, and sinking, meaning you have, you know, surface ocean water going down to the deep. That physical movement of water vertically through the oceans is also hugely important for whether it is releasing CO2 into the atmosphere or absorbing CO2 from the atmosphere. And so, you know, that temperature effect, whether that would be a large enough effect to affect ocean acidification is a really interesting question. I don't think I have an answer off the top of my head to that, but I'll tell you, it's something I'm going to go look at a little bit, because it's a really interesting question.
Yeah, good one. And certainly temperature played a role in the discovery of, say, the dead zone off of the Pacific Northwest of the United States back in maybe 2008, where upwelling of very cold water was bringing very nutrient-rich and carbon dioxide-rich water to the mm-hmm. surface. And then you get these anoxia events as the productivity of the microbial communities just takes off. So that is an excellent question. Also, on climate.gov yesterday, I noticed that we published a story about a sail drone circumnavigating Antarctica. And there's a pretty cool visualization of the data coming out of this drone as it circles the Southern Ocean around Antarctica. And you can see areas where the drone is measuring that carbon dioxide is going into the ocean. And then there's areas where you can see the carbon dioxide coming out of the ocean during the austral or Southern Hemisphere winter. So I was really curious when you were talking about this, about the role that phytoplankton play
yeah.
in the carbon cycle of the ocean and taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. You talked a lot about the chemical, physical process of dissolving carbon dioxide, but I'm really interested also in that biological pump.
Yeah, so there's a famous hypothesis by a Professor Martin who suggested that if you just took a tanker full of liquefied iron or iron in water solution, of iron dissolved in water, and just dumped it into the Southern Ocean, that you could trigger an ice age. And the reason for that is that there are massive sections of the Southern Ocean where there's just not enough iron in the ocean water to support all the microbial and phytoplankton life. And so he suggested that, you know, if you just dump a bunch of iron there, then all of a sudden we can have more life. And what that life does, it absorbs CO2. And then when it dies, it takes that carbon down deep into the ocean. And that's essentially removing CO2 from the atmosphere and depositing it deep in the ocean, where it'll get stored as basically mud, you know, carbon-rich mud for millions of years. And so we do believe that at least during the ice ages, we kind of ran that experiment, right? We didn't dump a tanker of iron out there, but what we did is we increased the winds around the world. We know that the ice ages were much windier than today. And so that kicked up a lot more dust out of the deserts, like the Sahara and especially down in Patagonia. And that dust would sprinkle down onto the Southern Ocean and deliver iron and actually help to cause phytoplankton blooms. And so we think that that is one of the ways during the ice ages that we reduced CO2 in the atmosphere is by inducing these blooms. And then again, that carbon gets sucked out of the atmosphere by the critters. And then those critters die and sink down to the ocean and get buried as carbon-rich mud. So that is another mechanism by which we naturally can change CO2 in the atmosphere. What's interesting is that that hypothesis, the Martin hypothesis, was really popular as sort of the go-to reason why CO2 changed during the ice ages. That was the hypothesis back in, say, the 90s and even in the early 2000s. And what we're finding more and more in the research is that, yes, that probably did go on, but we think that these physical differences of where the ocean is rising and where the ocean water is sinking are probably more important than this biological component. And we've actually I have not done this, but oceanographers have actually run these experiments. They've done the Martin hypothesis. They literally took boatloads of this soluble iron and dumped it in the Southern Ocean and tried to see what happened. And what they found is that, yes, you can induce a phytoplankton bloom. But the problem is that when those phytoplankton die, they don't sink all the way down to the bottom. They just sink a little bit, and then something bigger comes along and eats them. And therefore, the carbon is not actually sinking down and being trapped as carbon-rich mud in the bottom. It's staying in that surface ocean water where it eventually makes its way back into the atmosphere as CO2. So they've done that experiment large scale at least 5 or 6 times now, and they always come to the same conclusion. So while we do think that that was something that was happening over the ice ages, people have thought about it as a way to try and reduce CO2 in the future, like a geoengineering solution. And it looks like that that geoengineering solution is probably not the way to go.
Hmm. You mentioned earlier when we started this conversation that humanity is in this place of understanding it, the role we play in shaping the Earth system. Just at a critical time where we may also be learning that we're doing it at a scale that's, that's locked in some changes, and it's to some extent some are irreversible. But we're also at a time where we have this synoptic perspective that wasn't possible even 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I appreciate that because I, earlier in my career, worked a lot with satellite data and did some visualization of ocean primary productivity. And if you look at the winds of the Southern Ocean stirring up the nutrients, you can see these phytoplankton blooms that just are incredible to witness. The Falkowski model of phytoplankton productivity was used to produce a satellite data product that showed primary productivity, carbon dioxide being taken out of the ocean. It's just a beautiful reminder that biology and the physical system of our planet work together. So on that note, I wondered if there were any other things that you wanted to share about sort of your passion or love for the work you're doing, because after all, it's people that do science. And I think that that sometimes gets lost in the discussion around climate change. Maybe you could share one or two things that you're really passionate about, just on a personal level.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a father. I've got two kids, a fourth grader and a first grader. And so to me, I think a lot about them when I think about climate change. And, you know, a question that I get asked a lot after giving, you know, a public presentation or a seminar like this is, you know, aren't you depressed? Like, this is depressing stuff. Like, how do you work on this every day? And like, is there hope? And, you know, I am actually an optimist. I'm an optimist, I guess, by nature, but I am optimistic that we are going to get our act together when it comes to becoming better stewards for this planet. And that doesn't just include dealing with our carbon emissions and worrying about climate change, but of course, on a myriad of issues, whether it's trying to preserve biodiversity in our rainforests, and we see what's happening in Brazil now, or it's you know, doing a much better job with our waste, and we can think about the plastic problem in the ocean and the way that we deal with our waste in general and how little that we reuse and recycle our waste. I am optimistic that we're going to start doing better on this. I feel like, you know, things have come a long way, even just in my relatively short career. I mean, the certainty that we now have about humans' role in all of these issues has just exploded in the last couple of decades. I mean, when I was a graduate student in the early 2000s, a PhD student starting to work on this, there's no way I would have stood up in front of an audience and said, all of the warming that we've seen since 1970 is from humans. We just didn't have that kind of certainty. And now we do, right? And so we've come a long way. I think it feels like things are slow, but there's reasons to be optimistic. I mean, one of the things I think about a lot with our carbon emissions is our energy use, right? And the explosion of wind and solar energy in this country, even though we're still lagging behind many other countries, the explosion is remarkable. And it exceeds all the expectations and all the projections that the professionals who work in the energy market would have expected. And so, you know, the price of wind, the price of solar in particular is just plummeted. These things are becoming cost competitive. It's now actually cheaper to install a large solar panel array than it is to install a new grid scale natural gas plant, which used to be the cheapest way to make energy. It's cheaper to do solar now, at the grid scale anyway. So, like, we're coming to this, the technology is coming to this critical threshold where it's now actually, it's not that we have to give something up. It's not that we have to sacrifice in order to become greener or produce less carbon, but it's actually cost beneficial to produce less carbon, right? And that's a critical transition point. And so I feel like if we can make this energy transition, then we've got a really good chance of coming out of this on the other side with a world that we still all want to live in. And I am an optimist. So when I teach these students here at Dartmouth, you know, they're passionate about this and they all get it. They've been hearing about climate change since they were in elementary school. It's not new to them like it is, say, for my parents, the older generations, who are still oftentimes still trying to get their head around this idea. To the next generation, they understand this a little bit better. And when they start leading and they're making the big decisions, I think that it's just going to be ingrained in the decisions they make that they're going to try and be more sustainable. So that's, I guess, the message I'd like to leave off with is that despite all the bad news that we've been talking about today and in the webinar yesterday and all this stuff that I spend my career studying, I'm an optimist. And I, more than being an optimist, I want to continue to work hard to try and make that optimistic future actually come to be.
Well, thank you very much for your hard work. I really appreciate your time, Eric. My guest today has been Eric Osterberg, and you can check out his website. We'll have a link along with this recording. Until next time, thank you very much.